Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. Today, we open our show with a disturbing story out of Ocotillo, where yet another massive wind turbine has collapsed at the facility sending electric power to San Diego. The site has had a troubling history of catastrophic accidents, including an earlier turbine collapse, a blade hurled off onto a public trail, a turbine that burst into flames, and more, leading residents to raise serious safety concerns that you'll hear about on our show today. Then, from Public News Service's 2021 Talks, hear why the U.S. is apologizing for a drone strike in Afghanistan that mistakenly targeted civilians, get an update on that J6 rally at the Capitol, and more top news. Our newsmaker today is Stephen Prusky, a director with Rescue Task Force. The nonprofit that has its roots in East County has been responding to disasters around the world for decades, but also established schools for girls and women in Afghanistan. And now, their coordinator and his family are trapped and in hiding inside Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover, which has forced closure of the schools. He'll share inside accounts on the dire situation there in our interview on today's show. From Public News Service, we'll also have updates on Haitian migrants at the border, the financial impacts of new anti-abortion legislation, and more national news stories. And on Destination East County, we'll have all the most fun festivals and events coming up across our inland region, including some chilling and thrilling Halloween events. Cleveland National Forest and other state forests are shut down due to high fire danger. That includes some of East County's most popular hiking trails. We'll have details along with some wildfire preparedness tips for you amid this week's hot, dry weather conditions. And finally, from California News Service, hear about a new program to bring laptops to older Americans. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Residents in Ocotillo, California, are voicing concerns after yet another wind turbine collapsed at the Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility on Thursday, September 16th. There were no injuries or damage to other structures when the 300-foot-tall turbine crashed to the desert floor at the trouble-prone facility. But residents are raising serious questions over public safety at the site, which produces energy sent to SDG&E to power the San Diego region. Another turbine collapsed back in 2016 at the project, which was built on public land owned by the Bureau of Land Management. The manufacturer, Siemens Gamesa, blamed that failure on a malfunction that resulted in a blade striking the tower. Ocotillo Wind, built by Pattern Energy, also has had a wind turbine fire in January 2015 and an 11-ton blade hurled off onto a public trail in 2013, among other failures, as we reported at the time. The project has about 112 turbines total. Our investigation after the blade fell off found that Siemens had a long history of wind turbine failures, as well as allegations that included bribery, corruption, and other scandals around the world. In 2014, East County Magazine revealed that an international wind expert concluded the project's developers defrauded the federal government to pocket subsidies, falsifying data to imply the site had higher wind speeds than it did. In records that we pulled for several years after the project was built, it failed to produce the amount of promised power each time. Residents of Ocotillo have been subjected to perils resulting from the wind project beyond blades hurling off and turbines collapsing. Stripping bare topsoil has led to massive dust storms, and chemicals used to control dust resulted in potentially toxic white sludge flowing through the streets during storms, a substance that becomes flammable when it dries out. For beleaguered residents, enough is enough. According to Linda Wells, who has lived in Ocotillo for over 30 years, it's been the hottest summer ever, and the turbines are just breaking down. It's just the kind of thing they said would never happen. She complains of old turbine blades left lying around, as well as many gallons of oil used to lubricate the blades now slung across the desert floor, above an aquifer used for drinking water. Linda's husband, Park Ewing, created a Facebook page called Ocotillo Wind Turbine Destruction, documenting the many problems at the site. The project was among the first to be fast-tracked by the federal government with a goal to accelerate production of clean, green energy to help combat climate change. The estimated lifespan of a wind turbine is about 20 years, and it's unclear why Ocotillo has had so many serious equipment failures with the Siemens Gamesa turbines. Beth O'Brien, a spokesperson for Pattern Energy, responded to questions sent by Park Ewing about the latest turbine collapse, which occurred within a designated setback zone around the turbine base. No one was injured, the Pattern spokesperson confirmed in the email forwarded to our media outlet. She adds, "We are working closely with the turbine manufacturer Siemens Gamesa to identify the root cause of the failure, and a full investigation is underway. Relevant authorities have been notified. We are taking this issue very seriously and will communicate more information as it becomes available," she said. Gilbert Ribelar, County Public Information Officer, told the Imperial Valley Press that the county is aware of the incident and has established communication with Pattern Energy. But some residents are fed up with problems at the wind site. Resident Linda Muir sums up the views of many in her post on Facebook, which states, "Will they all have to collapse before they clean up any of the property?" Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We now assess that it is unlikely that the vehicle and those who died were associated with ISIS-K or were a direct threat to U.S. forces.
Commander General Kenneth McKenzie apologized for the deaths of 10 civilians, including 7 children killed in a U.S. drone strike August 29th in Kabul. The driver of the targeted vehicle, Zemurai Amadi, was a longtime employee at a humanitarian organization. The U.S. military says it mistakenly thought the vehicle was carrying ISIS-K fighters that posed a threat to evacuation efforts. Family members of the dead want compensation and an investigation and punishment for those responsible. Heightened fears about a justice for J6 rally in Washington Saturday eased when the event fizzled. The Capitol rally, held in support of January 6th insurrection defendants, only drew a small crowd. Event organizer and former Trump campaign aide Matt Brainard.
"This is about equal treatment under the law. This is about a public investigation into many of the things that happened that have not been investigated publicly, especially the death of Ashley Babbitt."
A review by Kaiser Health News found lawmakers in every state proposed legislation to curb public health powers during the pandemic. Most bills failed or were vetoed, but half of states enacted laws permanently weakening government health authority. Meanwhile, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky says her organization is launching a $2.1 billion initiative to strengthen the nation's local health departments.
"This includes improving laboratory capacity to detect infectious threats, training healthcare workers in a first-of-its-kind program, and expanding data so we can track infections real-time and monitor progress."
President Biden's COVID team says vaccination requirements are a cornerstone of combating the Delta variant. Jeff Zients, White House COVID-19 response coordinator, says Biden recently met with big employers, including Microsoft and Disney, who are working to implement worker vaccination rules.
"Vaccination requirements work, and they're good for the economy. At United Airlines, the vaccination rate among employees has gone from 59% to 90% in just 6 weeks.
France has recalled its ambassadors to the United States and Australia in protest of a new agreement on the sale of nuclear-powered submarines. Australia broke an arms contract with France in favor of the U.S. deal, designed to push back on Chinese power in the region. Former State Representative Beto O'Rourke is planning to run for Texas governor in 2022. A new poll shows the one-time presidential and Senate candidate still faces an uphill battle against Republican incumbent Greg Abbott. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording from our studio in East County. Today, I'm speaking with Stephen Prusky, who is a director at Rescue Task Force. They are a nonprofit that actually started here in San Diego's East County, and they're now headquartered in Temecula. They're perhaps best known for bringing medical teams to places that are in need in areas around the world, such as Southeast Asia and Central America, as well as responding to disasters around the world, helping survivors, including Hurricane Ida most recently. But they've also long had a team inside Afghanistan, among other things, establishing schools to educate girls. And now that work has been decimated by the Taliban takeover after the U.S. troop withdrawal, and Rescue Task Force's own coordinator and his family are trapped inside Afghanistan. As I mentioned, my very special guest today is Stephen Prusky, a director at Rescue Task Force. Stephen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure, and I appreciate it.
In these tough times, especially, can you start by telling listeners who may not be that familiar with it about Rescue Task Force work in Afghanistan? How did that ever get started, and what did you accomplish over there?
Well, it goes back quite a way, actually. So the gentleman, one of the two gentlemen who started Rescue Task Force, Gary Bex and Wendell Cutting, started going into Afghanistan in 1987. And at that time, they were bringing food aid to those people that were being impacted under the Soviet occupation.
Yeah.
And while they were there, they were introduced to a gentleman we will refer to in this interview as Ghulam, who was their guide and their aide. And it was actually introduced to them by Armand Karzai, the former head of Afghanistan.
And I assume we're using aliases, listeners, for some of these so that we don't put anybody in danger who
that
may still be in Afghanistan.
That is correct. And that's why I said we'll call Ghulam.
Yes.
That is not his real name.
Ghulam, okay.
Anyway, Gary, Wendell, and I'm sorry, unfortunately, Wendell has passed, but they all became very close friends and kept in touch. And in 2002, began to shoot the idea around of bringing education literacy centers to women. And of course, that was forbidden under the Taliban.
Right.
But in 2002, after the United States had gone into Afghanistan, they started off by setting up what they called a shade tree project. They used out-of-pocket money and began to meet under trees, literally, and to educate these young and older women, I might add.
Yeah, good for them.
And from that, it developed relatively quickly. Ghulam is a very industrious, very intelligent guy, and we had a very kind sponsor in South California who was helping with all of this. And without going into too much more detail, over the course of the years, Ghulam set up 21 to 23 literacy centers for these women.
My goodness.
We have had, and we're running until June or so of this year, literally weeks before Kabul fell. We had 12,000 students in these schools.
Wow.
3,000 of whom gained enough proficiency to go into secondary school. And I can talk a little bit more about that in a moment.
Oh, my. Yeah, that's amazing.
And some on to college. And it really was amazing. There's a Afghani proverb that Ghulam shared with us saying that those who cannot read are blind. And we want our women to be healthy.
My goodness.
And that may be something we all accept here in the West, but obviously it's a difficult situation in countries like Afghanistan.
Yeah, I know so many countries around the world where people are illiterate, but Afghanistan in particular is so difficult for the women because of the oppressiveness of the Taliban regime.
Indeed, indeed. So now, I would say, just to by a bit of a context, that in Afghanistan, while the United States was there, women could only go on to secondary school if they had demonstrated a certain proficiency level. Mm-hmm. And that was our primary goal. So that these women and children and young women mm-hmm. Would, on one hand, be able to go to secondary school and develop their education further.
Yeah.
But even for those who were older and were not going on to secondary school, it was of enormous help, not only for their own self-esteem, but it enabled many of them to set up businesses of their own, help mm-hmm. their children with their homework, be able to tabulate and read things in supermarkets, things that we take for granted, they were unable to do.
Yeah, there's such an independence in a way that comes with being able to read and not being quite so reliant on someone else to do all of that for you. I can't imagine how difficult that would be. And then the opportunities, of course, that it presents for those who can go on
to higher education to aspire to be, you know, doctors or whatever they want to be. And that's all.
We can only pray that the time comes back in Afghanistan where this kind of work can resume.
We all certainly hope that. What has happened now since the country fell to the Taliban? We hear a lot about it on the news, but what are you hearing from your inside sources who are still on the ground about the situation there right now, especially for the women and girls?
I'm sorry to tell you what we are hearing and seeing, as we've been able to receive some videos as well.
Yeah,
we'll start with the women and the girls. The most recent international news you may have read was that boys are now back allowed into secondary school programs. Girls are not.
Well.
So notwithstanding the Taliban's promises to treat women equally, that's falling. That is just not happening.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody really believed they would treat women equally, but we had hoped that at least it might be somewhat better than the last time they were in power. And apparently that's not the case.
That's not the case. And we are seeing videos of women and teenage girls being pulled from houses and forcibly married off or given basically to Taliban fighters. That is now resuming. We've seen people beheaded for some of the work they've done.
I was just going to ask, have you had retaliation against any of your teachers or people who worked at these schools?
At this point, we have heard not too much of that.
Good.
In the sense that the teachers have been able to fade back in the background. And I should tell you, these literacy centers were all taking place in the Hazara region of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
It's up in the mountains. And although there have been issues in the past, and we'll talk a little bit about some of them, at this point, from what we have heard, they have not gone aggressively after those teachers that were helping. Of course, Ghulam and his family are in hiding, and they fear for their life for good reason.
I can only imagine. What are your, without giving away any details that could
sure.
compromise where they are or their any escape plan they may have, but do you have substantial prospects for getting them safely out of Afghanistan?
Well, we've been working diligently. We started with an organization in Philadelphia called HIAS, mm-hmm. and they connected us to Global Immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And we have all but secured, we're waiting for the word, which we hope any day, something called humanitarian parole or humanitarian parole visas for Olive Ghulam and his family. He has five children and a wife with him in hiding, and one child, a daughter, in a neighboring country, without going into details,
yeah.
who at this point is safe, but she's not able to go back into the country.
No.
All of his children, or all of his adult children, helped with the literacy centers. They all have targets on their back.
I bet. And I understand, to be clear now, you've had to close down all of the literary centers. Is that correct?
We did. They were running until literally 2 to 3 weeks before Kabul fell.
Mm.
Ghulam has been quite diligent in making this happen, and his support staff, meaning the people in the Hazara region, have been incredible.
What happened to all of the materials? Were any of those salvaged, or did they have to be burned or destroyed to prevent tying them to the people that are doing the work?
Sure. To my knowledge, the books and the literacy tools we've received have been dispersed and hidden, and they're just not out and visible.
Yeah. So. Now, what about, for the teachers or anyone else that helped you there, is there any hope of getting any of them out, or do they want to leave?
Well, most of them are back with their families.
Mm-hmm.
We have not been involved yet in trying or hoping to get any of them out. And it actually has not come up in discussion with Ghulam yet.
Yeah.
But I suspect that's going to be a bridge too far for us, as much as it's hard for me to say that.
Yeah, I can imagine. It has to be just devastating for the girls who attended those schools and learned to read and had such hopes for the future, as well as for the older women, too, who do still possess that knowledge now that they didn't have before. So there's something, that all of your hard work brought to bear there. But do you have any hope that maybe someday the pendulum may switch the other way, that perhaps, is there any hope of the Taliban, in your view, someday falling from power? Or that international pressures could be brought to bear while they're in power to perhaps, persuade the Taliban to ease up on at least some of the restrictions on the women and girls?
Well, both the United States and the international community have already put substantial pressure on the Taliban. They have threatened things domestically, diplomatically, forgive me.
Yeah.
And as I'm sure you've heard, the U.S. controls quite a bit of currency that they could, that they're holding from the Afghan government, and the international community holds another piece as well. Whether that will be used as leverage or not, no, I don't know. But I will tell you, I am not optimistic for the foreseeable future. The pendulums invariably swing in history one way and the other. But
it could be generations or decades before.
I am quite fearful that it will be, yes.
Yeah.
But so you are right. The girls and the women, some of them have gone on, and obviously those with significant professional careers may have a lot of difficulty continuing those careers. They will always have their knowledge inside of them. They will be able to help their children in school as they do. Mm-hmm. Presumably, you know, many of the day-to-day activities that have already been engendered will be able to continue. But unfortunately, educating further, unless they take it upon themselves to help each other, is a dim prospect for the foreseeable future. And it makes my heart quite heavy to have to say that.
Yeah, it's such a tragedy.
Stephen, if I may, Miriam, I wanted to, just to give you on that note, I have with me a quote from one of the young women who wrote in appreciation. We had a board member, by the way, go to Afghanistan just before COVID and visit these centers, and they were thriving. And of course,
I know I've interviewed Gary Beck about them in the past, and he was so proud of it. And it just sounded like such wonderful things were being accomplished over there.
It was tremendous. And this young woman wrote how she was blind. She not literally. She said, "I was blind, and I have been. My eyes have been treated with the light of knowledge." And to me, that just speaks volumes as to what this brought the young women and the older women, and what they are now going to be missing out on. And it's just a tragedy. It's a tragedy upon tragedies in Afghanistan.
You know, it is a tragedy on tragedy. A little history, you know, for listeners. The U.S., of course, has been at war in Afghanistan for over 20 years under four different presidents. It started under George W. Bush after 9/11, you know, of course, going in to try to hold Al-Qaeda accountable. It continued under Barack Obama, even after the capture of Osama bin Laden. President Donald Trump forged a peace treaty with the Taliban and freed some 5,000 Taliban prisoners and promised withdrawal of U.S. troops, but delayed actually doing that, the pullout, until after he left office. I don't believe that they worked to evacuate some of the people at risk. At least there were certainly many left behind.
Yep.
Joe Biden, I suppose he could have canceled that, but he chose to honor the Trump agreement, delayed it a few months, but ultimately did withdraw all the troops, trying to get them out by the 20-year anniversary of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And you know, did get about 100,000 civilians out, and one of the largest evacuations ever. But there were many others who were left behind, and they certainly grossly underestimated how quickly the country would fall to the Taliban if they believed that would happen at all, and how quickly the Afghan government crumbled. I mean, it's been blamed on corruption and ghost troops on the payroll and all kinds of things. But in hindsight, I got to ask, Stephen, as somebody who, you know, has had people on the ground there forever, what do you think could have done differently? Do you think any of these presidents, you know, could have changed the course of the outcome? Was Biden wrong to actually end the war? Or could more have been done to stop a takeover and prevent those most vulnerable without just, you know, a slaughter of U.S. troops? We, of course, had ISIS-K in there, too, you know, plotting attacks on our troops at the end.
Well, you'll forgive me if I am a bit diplomatic when it comes to specific kinds of politics.
Yeah.
I think it's very clear that there could have been more preparation. One of the shames here, in our case with Ghulam, for example, was that he had already applied for a visa. And he was, I think, 10 days away from his interview at the embassy when Kabul fell.
Oh, how awful. How long ago did he apply for his visa?
I think once the writing was on the wall with the arrangement for under President Trump, he began the process. The application had to go through a number of steps because he was, of course, applying for seven family members.
So it's been through two administrations then. It's still
well, no, it goes back at least to early part this year. But he was, again, I have to stress how dedicated this man and his family and his community were in pursuing this project. Against all odds.
We've certainly heard about some people who'd had their applications in for years and still didn't get the approval to get out, including some of the Afghans who helped our troops who were translators or things.
I know,
some of the contractors, and the contractors are gone and they can't get their records. So
you can write off the haste to any number or the rapidity with which the government and the defenses fell.
Mm-hmm.
There are those who are inside that would have told you all along it was going to go quickly, in part because forgetting even the corruption and everything else, that you had soldiers that were demoralized, that knew they were ultimately not going to have the protection and were faced with fighting the Taliban and getting killed or giving up perhaps and surviving. So that's one of many contributing factors. Could more have been done? I suspect so. I wish so. And I'm hoping that that our government, and as you mentioned, the international community, can bring the pressure to bear to at least help those that are there get out, and then ultimately, over time, try to establish a fairer society.
Is there more that the United Nations can do right now in terms of, I'm seeing some reports of hunger across Afghanistan, meeting basic needs right now? Is that something that is being done, or is the Taliban blocking things like that?
It's quite clear that hunger is a developing problem, and more problems will surface over the coming weeks and months. I have heard, and I can't tell you that I have more advanced sources than you, these various food projects are being discussed and tentatively set up. It is an open question as to what the Taliban will allow. I wouldn't draw the analogy too far, but you've seen before, we've heard stories of mass starvation in North Korea, and they don't allow certain kinds of food aid in. So it is yet to be seen. But you can also be assured that if there is an opportunity, as small as we are, a rescue task force will seize that opportunity and do whatever we can do.
Yeah, your people have been absolutely courageous going into some of the most dangerous situations all around the world. Can you talk a little bit, Stephen, about some of the other projects that Rescue Task Force is working on right now in different parts of the world?
I would love to, but I'd like to take a moment first to tell you that I am really in awe of these coordinators. They have done incredible things at substantial risk. Not to digress too far, we have a coordinator who was working with, among other things, she's in Myanmar, and we've had a number of projects set up in Myanmar, and she was one of our most significant assistants there. She is now stuck there with her brand new child and her recent husband. Her work, individually, somewhat apart from Rescue Task Force, had to do with helping people that were victims of sex trafficking and getting them across the border and out of Myanmar, the border primarily being Thailand. But we had set up a number of projects in Myanmar that she and two other people were instrumental with, in terms of bringing food aid to remote villages, bringing education. We had started projects that are continuing now in several countries in Southeast Asia.
Very good.
That include water filters that can be bought very inexpensively. We, of course, donate them and can bring fresh water to homes. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in various countries. We have, as I said, education projects. One of my personal and Gary's favorite projects we've run now in Cambodia as well as Laos, which is bringing hygiene education to young women who might otherwise, the problem of dealing with menstruation at a young age in these countries very often is a taboo subject. It's not discussed. And so the young women may drop out of school because they're embarrassed by getting their period. They may feel shame about what's going on. And even worse, they may be using things that are not clean and healthy and can ultimately impact them very negatively.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
So we have set up these projects in various countries in Southeast Asia, and so far it's been very successful.
Well, good for you. Now, you're also doing some disaster relief projects. I understand you've been active recently in Haiti. What can you tell us about the situation there and what you're doing?
So Gary, among his other life journeys, is a former firefighter and a former medic from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And when he first set up with Wendell Rescue Task Force so long ago.
Yeah, and we should mention, by the way, for our local listeners here in San Diego East County, a lot of you may remember Wendell, who used to be a top staffer for Congressman Duncan Hunter way back when. Senior, Duncan Hunter Senior, I should add.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And his brother, Larry, is a board member still.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we, Wendell has a few projects we've dedicated specifically to him. I did not have the pleasure of meeting Wendell, but I have heard just wonderful, wonderful things.
Everybody said good. I know liberal Democrats, you know, who may have disagreed with the congressman's politics, but everybody praised Wendell and his good works and certainly the work of Rescue Task Force, which is.
Politics aside,
yeah,
we like to think most people are good humanitarians, and that's what really should bring us all together.
Yeah, it definitely. So back to Haiti.
We started Rescue Task Force as a response team, and we have been there for earthquakes and hurricanes and tidal waves and so forth. So with Haiti, we arranged to bring in various supplies by the container, working with another organization not far from you, World Emergency Relief, which has done just fantastic things all over the world. Primarily with logistics in terms of securing what we call goods in kind and getting them delivered. And we work hand in hand with World Emergency Relief. So we have worked with them to bring aid to a number of countries. We had a container of medical supplies that went down to El Salvador in May of this year to help with COVID. And as you pointed out, we had supplies going to Haiti recently, primarily actually relief supplies for the workers that were there.
Mm-hmm.
To help the rescue workers that came and give them assistance and aid and drink and so forth.
Yeah. And you're helping with Hurricane Ida right now. Whereabouts?
Also in coordination with World Emergency Relief, getting truckloads of supplies to the people that need them.
Yeah. Well, you're doing so much amazing work. Stephen, if listeners out there want to help out, what kind of help do you need?
We could always use funding. I'm sure it's a trite response, but I have to tell you what draw me. I've been working with RTF now for about 10 years, and I will continue for the foreseeable future. One of the many things that struck me about Rescue Task Force is that it runs on an ungodly budget. We have 95 to 98% of the money that we receive goes directly into our projects.
Yeah.
We don't have paid staff. This is a labor of love
for
those of us who are working that hard. And anything that we get, goods and primarily money, we channel to these projects. We have projects bringing wheelchairs to people in Asia that could not walk. And in Central and South America. Mm. We have, as I said, water filter projects. And let me take a moment, and I want to respond to your question directly, but I want to share a story with you.
Okay.
When we first went to the Mesquite Coast in Honduras, and we were in a very remote area, and the villages there were suffering terribly from parasites and diarrhea. Most of the kids we saw had extended bellies, distended bellies, really. And we brought them these little water filters that are made with clay and sand and a little bit of magic silver. And filter out 99.9% of the toxins and so forth that help, and parasites particularly. And going back a year later, we saw one distended belly.
Wow. What a
success. That's the kind of impact a $10 water filter can
have. Amazing.
And so that's what we will do. We work with local coordinators, local volunteers who are not paid, people like Gulam, mm-hmm. or the woman I mentioned in Myanmar, who are doing this to help their community. And we generally don't go in there and set up massive projects that need lots of ongoing support where people have to continue to pour money in. We set up the local infrastructure on a shoestring budget, make sure that it's self-sustaining with our local people.
Very good.
And continue to provide aid. We set up medical clinics and mobile dental clinics where we go to these more remote areas where they haven't seen doctors and dentists. These are all volunteers. They come from medical schools and dental schools. They're professors or dental students or recent graduates that give of their time. And all RTF has to do in the case of bringing containers or helping these things is either to get the transportation so we can get these goods and these people to where they need to go, or in the case of the water filters, buy these water filters for what is really a pittance that save lives.
So it sounds like you need funding, maybe transportation, if somebody out there, you know, owns trucks or something.
Well, generally it's funding because we are working with places like World Emergency Relief that have these other established projects. Mm-hmm. We've set up a project in Philadelphia. I think you have something similar in Southern California where we have refrigerators and food deserts in the cities.
Wow.
Where people can come, and it's right here in California. There are several, for example, in Los Angeles.
Nice.
Where we're donating refrigerators, and then the community restocks them. But when we can, we will restock them. And those who can't afford food will come and take something out of the refrigerator.
That's great.
So little funding, and most of our funders are relatively small funders. It goes a tremendous way.
Yeah, yeah.
With very, very little overhead.
Do you need more volunteers?
We are sometimes reluctant to take volunteers. They will need to have special training before they come on missions with us.
Mm-hmm.
But that will be something we hope to do more of in the future.
Very good.
We have to make sure, of course, that those volunteers can pay their own way because, again, we work on a shoestring budget.
Yeah. And listeners, if you want to donate or get involved or learn more about Rescue Task Force, you can also sign up for their wonderful newsletter that keeps you abreast of all the things they're doing around the world. You can do that by going to www.rescuetaskforce.org. I'm going to let you have the final word today, Stephen. And certainly our hearts go out to your coordinator, Gulan, and his family over there and everyone that's been impacted. But I'm going to let you have the last word. What else would you like our listeners to know that we haven't already gone over?
To the listeners, I will say if anyone wants to reach out to me in particular, I will respond directly to them. I'm happy to share information or answer questions, do what I can to give more color or keep them posted. To you, I obviously want to say thank you for this opportunity to let your listeners know what's going on and what we all can do to help. It certainly is, I would request that your listeners write to their congressmen and ask them to do what they can to help all those people who help the United States and are trying to help their own country, to do what we can to help them.
Very good. I know of our East County representatives, I've been getting emails from them, and they all seem to be working on this issue and trying to, you know, lobby the Biden administration and the international community to do more in various ways. So we certainly hope that that the situation... that there's some hope for it to improve a little bit, and certainly to get Gulan and his family safely out of Afghanistan.
And prayers never hurt either. So
yeah, exactly.
Keep everyone in our hearts.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we all need to work together in this world.
We should all be doing that. Days. The whole world, I think, right now, lifting up a prayer and a plea for the safety of the people in Afghanistan, and especially the women and the girls over there who are just so vulnerable that maybe someday there will be an opportunity for them, once again.
Amen to that.
Stephen, I want to thank you very, very much for taking time out of your busy week to speak with us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you so much, Marian. Have a wonderful day.
You too.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station, KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is the Public News Service Daily Newscast for September 20th, 2021. I'm Mike Moen. The U.S. government over the weekend flew Haitians camped in a Texas border town back to their homeland and tried blocking others from crossing the border from Mexico. The Associated Press reports the action is viewed as a massive show of force that signaled the beginning of what could be one of America's swiftest large-scale expulsions of migrants or refugees in decades. The rapid expulsions are connected to a pandemic-related authority adopted by former President Donald Trump that allows for migrants to be immediately removed from the country without an opportunity to seek asylum. President Joe Biden exempted unaccompanied children from that order, but let the rest stand. Curbing access to reproductive health care services, including abortion, can have disastrous effects on economic well-being. That's according to a new report from the Women's Policy Research Institute. Diane Bernard takes a look at the findings.
A Democratic-led legislature in Virginia has eased some restrictions over the past few years, but the report shows lack of access results in loss of wages and sometimes leaving the labor force, hitting low-income Virginians the hardest. Nicole Mason, who heads the institute, says the Commonwealth's economy loses about $600 million a year due to state-level abortion restrictions.
Many of these restrictions that limit the reproductive health access to women, in the state of Virginia alone, we could see more than $2 billion in increased earnings for women ages 15 to 44.
Since Texas passed a law banning abortions after 6 weeks, before most people know they're pregnant, abortion rights erupted as a hot-button issue in Virginia's governor's race. Democrat Terry McAuliffe ran ads supporting the right to choose shortly after the law passed. Republican Glenn Youngkin has mostly avoided the topic, he says, to appeal to independent voters. I'm Diane Bernard.
Turning to the COVID crisis, one in five unvaccinated Kentucky residents say they're open to getting a COVID-19 vaccine, according to a new poll from the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky. The state's hospitals are filled with COVID patients, and the governor there says about 90 beds are left in intensive care units. 66 Kentucky hospitals report critical staffing shortages, and at least two dozen will soon receive backup help from the National Guard. The foundation CEO, Ben Chandler, sees the poll results as encouraging, showing there are still people open to learning more about the vaccine so they can be better protected against serious illness and death.
That's really good news, I think. We've got a chunk of people there who have yet to be vaccinated, but who plan to get vaccinated.
State data show the week of September 12th, the state's seven-day average COVID-19 positivity rate was nearly 14%, the highest recorded since Kentucky had adequate testing supplies. This is PNS. Latinos and other communities of color showed their newfound muscle in the 2020 elections, helping to vote Arizona Democrats into the White House and U.S. Senate. While those groups want to consolidate their electoral gains in the state's redistricting process, some say the state's Independent Redistricting Commission is making it difficult for them to participate. Victoria Grijalva Ochoa with One Arizona, an alliance of two dozen advocacy groups across the state, says by limiting the number of public hearings and not holding any in majority Latino communities, the commission isn't engaging all of Arizona's voters.
About 30% of the state's population is Latino alone, and that is big for us. We need to be properly represented in these upcoming maps because, you know, as you know, they're going to dictate the next 10 years of our lives.
The commission is made up of two Democrats, two Republicans, and an independent chair named by the governor. Before the independent panel, the state's political maps were drawn and approved by the GOP-controlled Arizona legislature. Final maps must be approved by late December. An emerging initiative is looking to address the digital divide for Hispanic households as Hispanic Americans become a growing part of the country's workforce. Eric Tegetoff has more.
A growing slice of the workforce is Hispanic, but a disproportionate number of Hispanic households don't have regular access to the internet. It could be cutting many off from the digital economy. An initiative is aiming to tackle this issue. In Oregon, the Hispanic population grew 30% between the 2010 and 2020 census, comprising 14% of the state's population. Diana Caba with the Hispanic Federation says one way to ensure people in these communities have the skills they need for the economy is to meet them where they are.
Recognizing that new technologies are dramatically changing the workforce requirements of our economy, for Latino nonprofits that are engaged in workforce training to best serve the needs of the people they train, the idea is to adapt the curriculum and develop capacity to prepare students and workers for the digital economy.
The Latino Digital Accelerator Initiative currently operates in 10 states, including Washington and California, but not yet in Oregon.
On the climate front, a nonpartisan group of mothers and climate scientists is on a nationwide education campaign to engage more people about the effects of climate change and actions they can take to make a difference. Colorado State University research scientist Melissa Burt co-founded the group Science Moms. She says from the day they're born, parents want to protect their children, and the warming climate is now a direct threat to them.
They have the climate change information and the resources that they need so that they can understand and feel comfortable sharing and having conversations around climate change.
During Climate Week, which runs through this coming Sunday, organizers will encourage businesses, governments, and others to fulfill and increase their climate commitments. This is Mike Moen for Public News Service, member and listener supported, heard on radio stations around the U.S. You can find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week. This week's Destination East County features some thrilling and chilling October events, including Oktoberfest in La Mesa and El Cajon, the Festival of Sunflowers and Bathhouse Bazaar in Hukumba Hot Springs, an Autumn Jubilee in Santa Isabel, the new El Cajon Foodie Fest, dinner and flamenco dancers in Lemon Grove, the Borrego Days Parade and Festival, the Lakeside River Park Conservancy's Trail of Terror titled Curse of the French Quarter, and Haunt Fest on Main in downtown El Cajon. The 48th annual La Mesa Oktoberfest returns October 1st through 3rd with all of the event's traditional activities. Those include three beer gardens, Glücklich Games, Dackeldorf Dachshund Village, a Ferris wheel, Kinder Carnival, craft fair, over 100 vendors, live music including oompa bands, dancing, traditional and international foods, and more. For details, you can visit lamesaoktoberfest.org. The German-American Societies invites you to celebrate Oktoberfest in El Cajon the weekends of September 24th through 26th and October 1st through 3rd. Festivities include oompa music by the Guggenbach Baum from Germany, German beers, food and desserts, dancing, kids' activities, vendors, and a raffle with a round-trip flight for two to Germany as the grand prize. This event takes place at the German-American Society's parking lot in El Cajon. Parking is limited, so a rideshare, a taxi from home, or a transit center is encouraged. For tickets and more information, you can visit OktoberfestElCajon.com. The Festival of Sunflowers is an annual exhibit featuring works of local artists. This year, it will be hosted by Gilliam Gallery on Old Highway 80 in Hukumba Hot Springs on October 2nd from noon to 6 p.m. Also on October 2nd while in Hukumba, the monthly bathhouse bazaar and street market with collectibles, crafts, tools, music, food, jewelry, clothing, and more will be held from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Hukumba's bathhouse. That's downtown next to the newly restored Lake Hukumba where visitors can now go kayaking. Fort Cross Old-Timey Adventures in Santa Isabel on Highway 78 near Julian invites you to their fifth annual Autumn Jubilee. The fall festivities happen Saturdays and Sundays now through October 30th. Activities include hay rides, hoedowns, cider pressing, fall crafts, candle dipping, and a reptile experience. You can also try your hand at archery, tomahawk throwing, or the Ghost Town Slingshot Gallery. Visit a pumpkin patch, make a fairy or a dinosaur for your garden, traverse a lilac maze, and more. Advanced reservations are recommended. For tickets and hours, you can visit fortcross.com/autumn-jubilee. Foodie Fest aims to reignite the city of El Cajon's restaurant and food services industries while celebrating the community's diversity. The event will be hosted on Saturday, October 9th from 4 to 8 p.m. on Prescott Promenade in downtown El Cajon. The San Diego East County Chamber of Commerce will feature up to 40 restaurants, catering services, and food trucks with tastings. The Downtown El Cajon Business Partners will feature entertainment, while St. Madeline's Sophie Center will offer arts and crafts for all ages. Pre-event tickets are available for the El Cajon Foodie Fest on Eventbrite, and day-of-event tickets will be offered on a space-available basis. The Lemon Grove Historical Society invites you to savor a gala dinner with live flamenco dancers on Saturday, October 9th at 5:30 p.m. in the H. Lee House Courtyard in Lemon Grove. The event celebrates Traganza Heritage Park, the new name of the cultural landscape that includes H. Lee House and the Parsonage Museum, reflecting the area's Spanish heritage. Guests can also vie for auction prizes. For tickets to the Lemon Grove Historical Society's Dinner and Flamenco event, you can visit lghistorical.square.site/events. The 55th Annual Borrego Days Desert Festival will take place October 23rd and 24th at Christmas Circle Community Park on Palm Canyon Drive in Borrego Springs. The hours are from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday and 10 to 3 on Sunday. The festive weekend includes a flyover, parade, live entertainment, dance floor, art exhibits, kids zone, food vendors, adult beer garden, car show, amateur talent show, and more. This year's theme is Welcome Back, according to the event's sponsor, the Borrego Springs Chamber of Commerce and Visitor Bureau. For more information on Borrego Days, you can visit borregodays.com. Lakeside's River Park Conservancy presents Trail of Terror, Curse of the French Quarter, the last two weekends in October from 7 to 11 p.m. That's on October 22nd and 23rd, and again on the 29th and 30th. Reawakened New Orleans townspeople want you to join their party. Swamp people want you off their land, and everybody wants you out. But will you make it out unscathed? The Trail of Terror is located at Lakeside's River Park Conservancy walking trail on Channel Road, across from the Lakeside Fire Department. You can find more information at lakesidetrailofterror.com. The 9th Annual Haunt Fest on Main takes place in downtown El Cajon on Friday, October 29th from 4 to 9 p.m. This family-friendly event features live music on two stages, as well as costume contests, carnival rides and games, a car show, candy challenge activities, a kids' zone, face painting, plus performances by TNT dancers, Arts in Motion, and Junior Crew. There's also a pumpkin patch, craft and game booths, an LED rock wall, inflatable jumps for kids, and a surprise movie in the park. Find all the chilling and thrilling details at hauntfest.org. You can find more details on these events and more at eastcountymagazine.org, in our events section and on our calendar, and in our Destination East County column. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
Cleveland National Forest is shut down until September 17th due to fire danger, along with federal forests statewide. The aim is to protect the safety of firefighters and the public during high fire danger conditions, with wildfires raging across much of the state. Here in San Diego County, the closures include popular hiking trails such as Cedar Creek Falls and Three Sisters Falls, as well as the Hauser and Pine Creek Wilderness areas and more. The closure was announced just before Labor Day weekend. Regional Forester Jennifer Everlead says, "We do not take the decision lightly, but this is the best choice for public safety." According to U.S. Forest Service press release, several factors led to this decision, including helping prevent visitors from becoming entrapped, decreasing the risk of new fires starting at a time of limited firefighting resources and strained hospital resources, and the potential of extreme fire conditions. Federal forest lands in California currently have record-level fuel and fire conditions, with fire behavior beyond normal past experiences, including fire tornadoes and wildfires that spread quickly overnight. More than 6,800 wildfires have burned 1.7 million acres across all jurisdictions in California so far this year. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
This is Shalais Sasson with a special report on wildfire preparedness from KNSJ's East County Magazine radio show, Now is the time to prepare for what is shaping up as a tougher than usual fire season. The firestorms of 2003 and 2007 taught us that homes with defensible space are far more likely to survive than homes without it. Defensible space is an area around the home where plants and trees are maintained to prevent fire from spreading quickly. A buffer zone gives firefighters a better chance to make a stand and save your home during a wildfire. Fire officials recommend clearing away dry brush to form a 100-foot buffer zone around your home. The buffer could include hardscaping such as tile, stone, or concrete patios and walkways, or fire-resistant landscaping such as succulents. Trim tree branches 6 feet above the ground so that low-hanging branches won't become ladders to spread of wildfire. Be sure to have a family evacuation plan in place and assemble a 72-hour survival kit. You can download it at readysandiego.org. Sign up
for East County Wildfire and Emergency Alerts
at www.eastcountymagazine.org, where you can find timely news stories posted live during emergencies. In addition, you can also register with Alert San Diego, the region's reverse 911 system, at readysandiego.org. During an emergency, you can also consult sdcountyemergency.com, the county's website with evacuation updates and maps.
Advocates for Older Americans are working to spread the word about a federal program to cut people's internet bills. The Emergency Broadband Benefit Program gives people who qualify a $50 credit on their monthly internet bill and a $100 voucher toward a laptop or other mobile device. AARP California State President Joe Garbanzos says for tribal communities, the program goes further, providing a $75 subsidy per month.
High-speed internet connection is not a luxury. It is a necessity because you need good internet to do social connections with friends and family, entertainment, telehealth, and work.
Congress approved $3.2 billion for the program, and $2.7 billion is still unused. So far, 5.3 million households have signed up, including 660,000 in California. To apply, go to aarp.org/BBP or text the word internet to the number 22777 or call 833-511-0311. People who qualify for the Lifeline program, Medicaid, SNAP, SSI benefits, or free or reduced price school lunches are encouraged to apply. Garbanzos says the income limits cover quite a few people, especially those who lost work during the lockdown.
Those that have been impacted by the pandemic, loss of income, if your income is $99,000 in 2020 or below, for single filers, you're eligible.
Joint filers who made up to $198,000 in 2020 can qualify. The temporary program will continue until the money runs out. Participants will be notified 60 days before the credits are scheduled to stop. This is Suzanne Potter for California News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators for accuracy and transparency at publicnewsservice.org.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. You can support independent public media for our region by making a donation or a sustaining monthly pledge of any amount at www.knsj.org. We're your community radio station. KNSJ 89.1 FM, The Scanso, serving the San Diego border region from the mountains to the sea. That's www.knsj.org.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.